From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Democrats and Republicans are preparing for a big week in Washington as former special counsel Robert Mueller prepares to testify before Congress on Wednesday about his report on Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible obstruction of justice by President Trump. Aaron Blake is senior political reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us now. Aaron Mueller is going to go before two House committees back to back on Wednesday, the Judiciary Committee and the Intelligence Committee. Here's the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, speaking on Fox News Sunday.
The report presents very substantial evidence that the president is guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, and we have to let Mueller present those facts to the American people and then see where we go from there, because the administration must be held accountable and no president can be above the law.
You heard him say high crimes and misdemeanors there. How are Democrats preparing for this big day on Wednesday?
Well, I think they view this as an opportunity to introduce this report to people who may not have read it as in detail as members of Congress have or journalists like you and I have. I think there was a CNN poll shortly after the report was released that showed only 3% of people had actually read the report. So I think that there is a significant amount of skepticism that Robert Mueller is going to come out and blow the lid off this entire thing and tell us a bunch of things that weren't already in the report. But having somebody who wrote that report and is intimately familiar with all of its details, Democrats think, could really drive home some of the points that maybe they haven't been able to drive home with their own rhetoric.
And today the president tweeted, quote, highly conflicted Robert Mueller should not be given another bite at the apple. What are Republicans doing as they prepare for this? Or are they going to use this as an opportunity to question Mueller about other things?
Yeah, despite the president's hesitation about endorsing Robert Mueller going up to Capitol Hill, I think that there is a sense among congressional Republicans that this is also an opportunity for them. This is an opportunity for them to drive home the fact that Robert Mueller did not find there was a conspiracy with the Russians during the 2016 campaign. They also view this as an opportunity to talk about how the investigation was launched. As with many hearings, we're going to see two separate narratives, one from the Democrats, and then every 5 minutes it's going to shift over to a completely separate narrative on the Republican side of the dais.
And how significant is this hearing overall, do you think? Is this going to be something that kind of sets the tone as we head into the election next year?
I think that there is a lot of anticipation for this among the president's opponents, and there has been for many, many months. There are really big reasons to be skeptical that this is ultimately going to be a huge deal, mostly because Robert Mueller himself is not anxious to testify. Also, he does not generally go outside of what's going to be, you know, a very narrow focus of what his job is. And he has served notice even in his public comments, his very brief public comments, that he is not going to step outside of the information that's in his report. So I would imagine that anybody who thinks this is going to be a real game changer as far as recasting the Trump presidency might walk away from those two hearings pretty sorely disappointed.
Although, as you said, most Americans have not read the report, so some of this information may be new to them and certainly in a different form. Let me ask you about something else that is going on right now. We continue to see President Trump doubling down on his attacks on the so-called squad, these Democratic Congresswomen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, and Ilhan Omar. Yesterday, he tweeted, I don't believe they're capable of loving our country. People have called these comments racist. Why is Trump continuing this line of attack?
Well, if you look at how he set this up from the beginning, it was clear that he wanted to make this all about setting up a contrast between himself and these four congresswomen. How he went about that clearly has made people around Trump uncomfortable as far as his rhetoric about going back to the countries that they came from, even though three of them are not immigrants. And then obviously the crowd's chant last week of send her back to Ilhan Omar, who is the one immigrant in that group. So they didn't like where this was going. I think if anything from those Trump tweets, I read into it that he is going to continue these attacks in a different way, questioning their patriotism, questioning how much they love their country. I think the people around the president would prefer that even if he doesn't actually, you know, include the part about returning to other countries.
Do you think that this whole fight has exposed a rift in the Democratic Party where Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, and these four congresswomen are not on the same page?
Yeah, that rift was very much publicly known in the week before the president initially launched this line of attack a couple weekends ago. That week was devoted, much of it, to Democrats bickering with one another about exactly who was in charge of the party. And then the president stepped in with these attacks and really inserted himself in this. So a lot of strategists, including ones that are sympathetic to the president or support the president, believes that he was kind of overshadowing what was already a significant rift and maybe giving them all a reminder of the common enemy that they all have.
That is Aaron Blake, senior political reporter for The Washington Post, as we look forward to another big week in Washington. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
How about that heat? At least six people died in the heat wave that hovered over half the country this past weekend. Just terrible. And hundreds of thousands in New York and Michigan lost power. Climate change means extreme heat events will be more common, and there's concern that utilities won't be able to handle that strain. Julie McNamara is an energy analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Julie, we know cooling demands cause most of the strain on the national electrical grid. Fans, air conditioners, refrigerators working harder. But take us beyond that. What else happens?
So in addition to increased electricity demand, we also see strain on power grid components themselves from this extreme heat, which makes them more prone to failure or not being able to work in these higher temperatures.
Yeah.
And that means that if anything goes wrong, there's less slack on the system, meaning the greater potential for outages.
Yeah. So it's not just the usage of the components of the grid. It's the actual heat on the grid. How do you, what kinds of things are people thinking about for the future? Because we know with climate change, we're going to have more of these extreme heat events.
That's right. And that's one of the things that's so important about thinking about climate change, because we have infrastructure that's meant to last decades. And that needs to be built for not just the conditions of the past, but that which we're expecting to see increase in frequency moving forward. So that's thinking about, are our systems resilient? So as we look to lower emissions, we're shifting towards cleaner resources, which are also able to better cope in these systems and in decentralized power grid, right? So if you have rooftop solar or batteries in a local community, you're better able to weather a storm, right? These outage events than if you were just reliant on the grid itself.
Well, you're also taking pressure off the grid by doing that. Look, this past weekend, we were lucky enough to be in a place that had no air conditioning but had a breeze. And we told ourselves, well, you know, this is good because it's fewer people, you know, just a couple, but fewer people using air conditioning and more for an elderly person or an infant who needs it. Is that really true? I mean, the fact that if you don't use it or if you cut back in New York City, for instance, utilities and buildings were demanding that people keep their air conditioners at 79 degrees, for instance, or 75. If you use less or don't use it at all, does it help the system?
Sure. So any single thermostat being raised a degree or two is negligible on the system. But when you aggregate that across a city, across a town, across a region, that can make a really big difference. And that's one of the most important tools we have in the face of these high electricity demand days. It's being able to shift the timing of our electricity use.
And can utilities, let's say a building or a utility has asked people to, you know, try to cool below 75 degrees. Is there a way of knowing whether or not people are doing that?
Historically, no. But as we start to get access to these smart thermostats, utilities can actually harness that ability to be able to flatten the use, right? To try to make it more efficient. So if you aggregate over a large number of thermostats, you can make a very small shift and be able to achieve great efficiency gains for the system and really help ensure that the power stays on.
Yeah. Looking to the future, which, as you say, we must, a warming of 1 degree Celsius can lead to a tenfold increase in above 100 degree days in New York City alone. What's the one thing that utilities can do, short of maybe changing out old components that will be affected by heat? What's the one thing an individual can do?
Well, so one of the most important things to recognize is that these heat wave events are currently locked in this endless cycle of worsening, because on peak demand days, we bring those least efficient, heaviest polluting power plants online. That's driving up emissions on worst air quality days and increasing emissions of greenhouse gases. So we need to be shifting to cleaner energy resources, which not only helps slow this cycle and limit the number of high heat days in the future, but also provide resilience right in the moment itself.
And what about people?
There's some ways in which we use electricity that you can push off running a dishwasher until later in the evening, once that peak period in the early evening hours has passed. But I think what's so important to know is that this is less about any given individual and much more about the system as a whole.
Julie McNamara with the Union of Concerned Scientists, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And if you were in the heat wave this past weekend, how'd you beat it? Let us know. Here and Now. Double.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat. Ever wish feeling too hot or too cold were optional? As summer heats up outside, just press for a thermal wave designed to provide cooling relief. Over-air-conditioned inside? Leave that sweater in the car and rely on Emberwave instead. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave. Control your comfort.
This is Here and Now. One of Broadway's biggest recent hits is currently touring the United States. The Tony-winning musical Dear Evan Hansen tells the story of Evan, whose lie about knowing a high school classmate who had killed himself spirals out of control largely because of social media. Joining me now are two of the stars of the touring cast, Ben Levi Ross, who plays Evan Hansen. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Jessica Phillips, who plays his mother, Heidi. Jessica, welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much.
So this show was a big hit on Broadway. It's a very modern story. Videos going viral, social media having a big impact. How have audiences been reacting to the show, first of all, around the country? Jessica, I'll start with you.
The stage door is an amazing experience, and it's an opportunity for us to meet fans. And it's remarkable to me every time I walk out and I see these teenagers there and their parents. Many are in tears. Many are shaking with excitement. Some people have said to me, this was my first time. I knew every word of the cast album, and I just can't believe I saw it come to life, and it's even better than I imagined. And then some people say, I've seen it 9 times, and it's just as great the 9th time. So thank you. Thank you for coming to our town. It's remarkable how this story has touched people across the nation.
Ben, you're not that far away from the generation that this story is about, right?
No.
How old are you?
I'm 21.
21. Yeah. I mean, what do you think? How are people reacting? What are people saying to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing is that a lot of people at the stage door could be my peers. Like, I'm supposed to be going into my senior year of college right now. So a lot of the people at the stage door could be my classmates, which is sort of like a weird, interesting, fun experience because this is my first professional job. So I've never sort of experienced people like standing on the opposite side of a barricade, like wanting my autograph, which is like sort of weird. But I think that also provides a level of comfort and familiarity when I go out and meet them. And like, if they are a theater student, which many of the kids at the stage door are or want to be, they can see that I am someone who's just like them, that
you're accessible,
that I'm accessible, that this is, you know, a possibility.
Well, and what about the message of the show itself? And, you know, we've done a lot of stories on this show about the issues that Generation Z are dealing with depression and anxiety and suicide, which obviously is a big part of Dear Evan Hansen. Do you hear from people about that and how these things that you're doing in the show touch them?
All the time. I mean, I have an Instagram account, and after every show, I pretty much get flooded with messages from kids that were in the audience that night, whether it be someone who's just thanking me for the show that they saw, or someone really like opening up and telling me that they have struggled with self-harm, or they have been depressed for the majority of their lives, or they have dealt with anxiety in the same way as Evan or Connor. And sometimes the end of the messages will sort of finish with, and now I'm doing a lot better, which is
great for me, and sometimes they don't. And when they don't, I feel a bit of a responsibility to make sure that that kid gets tended to. So I'll take a screenshot of that message and send it to our PR team, who then has someone from one of our organizations that we are partnered with, whether it be, you know, the Trevor Project, Child Mind Institute, Born This Way Foundation, one of those organizations will literally reach out to that kid directly and send them a message, and they can have a conversation with a professional.
Wow.
Because that's, you know, it ends up sort of becoming my responsibility in a way. Even though I am just the actor, I'm not going to let that just fall to the wayside.
Let's listen to a little bit of you as Evan in the show. This is called Waving Through a Window. I can tell by your reaction while we're playing that you're into the music of the show, both of you.
Just wondering if anyone is appreciating my ahs in the background.
Yes, honestly, I was. If no one else was, I was. So, I love the music. It's also, I was an understudy on Broadway for a year before this. So
you played another character on Broadway.
I played two other characters. Uh-huh. Yeah, I played Jared and Connor and Evan in New York. And Jessica's been listening to this music, obviously, for the year that we've been on tour, but for it to be 2 years for me of listening every night to the same score, you know, I still love it.
Yeah, it's infectious.
To this day, honestly.
I'm not tired of it.
No, me neither.
Well, okay, so let me ask you about that, Jessica. To do this for so long, night after night after night, and have to bring the emotion of this character, of the mother, into this show every night. How do you do that?
It is different every night, and my job is to say the dialogue as honestly as possible. But honestly, the entire character arc for me ends up being a bit of a meditative experience because it is so real and it is so anchored in actual words that I've said to my own sons and dialogue that almost every parent who's in the audience has said at one time or another, and feelings and emotions and experiences that most parents have had or are having, that I can't think about anything else. And so in those scenes, in the moments, especially when we're having these mother and son intense dialogues, I'm completely present and and I make it through that experience satisfied. Even though it wrings me out, it is a resolution of sorts, and it feels really satisfying to come through that.
Well, Ben, I mean, how do you do that? Do you draw from your own personal experience as well?
You know, there's something like magical. This sounds so ridiculous, but there's something kind of magical that happens every night. And at this point, I don't really know. I just go on stage and then it happens. And that sounds so simple and so general and so ridiculous. But at this point, that's like, I think I just have to like give myself over.
No, I think we're saying the same thing, which is that you're fully present.
I'm just present.
So you're
not
aware that you're working so hard in the moment that you're working hard.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what I observe when I watch Ben work.
Oh, thanks.
And by the way, in terms of the relationship that you two have in this show, it is a complicated one. And it starts off, and I want to listen to a little bit of you, Jessica, singing Does Anyone Have a Map? You're a mother talking about the frustration of having to kind of learn as you go as a parent.
Well, I'm kind of coming up empty, can't find my way to you. Does anybody have a map? Anybody maybe happen to know how the hell to do this? I don't know if you can tell, but this is me just pretending to know. So where's the map? I need a clue.
This is such a great song to kind of, one of the early ones in the show, because it really, everybody can imagine what that mother is going through.
Right. Where is the rule book?
Where's the rule book for this?
Come on, somebody tell me. Yeah, it's a universal feeling. It's a universal experience, I think, for most parents.
Ben, when you were on Broadway in this show, and you mentioned that you had played a couple of other characters, but one of them was Jared, who's Evan's friend. What was it like to go from playing that role to playing this role in the same show?
I loved playing all of the roles that I understudied on Broadway. And also, I will say that the one thing that I carried over from that experience into playing Evan full time was that it sort of gave me a level of empathy for these other two roles that I played. I understood why Jared was insecure. I understood why Connor mm-hmm. was lashing out a little bit more than I would have understood had I just seen the show from Evan's perspective.
So now you could just write a book about all the characters
no,
in Dear Evan Hansen.
At this point, it could be a one-person show. One I could say this, show. You know. Yeah.
Now, we have to play one more piece of tape because this is kind of amazing, which is that you played Jared opposite Taylor Trench playing Evan, yeah. And we've got some sound of a video that the show released last Valentine's Day, the two of you singing Only Us. Here it is. Now, it gets even more amazing, which is that the two of you are in a relationship.
We sure are. Yes, I am. Two Evan Hansens. I met Taylor a month before he even started rehearsals as Evan.
Do you give each other tips on playing Evan Hansen?
We sure don't. We sure don't. We try and keep, our
work
sort of,
at work.
Yeah, work at work. But I will say that this year has been made 1,000 times easier having the person that is your partner be the one who understands this job mm-hmm. the best.
Okay, I want to just finally do a little lightning round with both of you here and ask some quick questions. When you get the night off, what do you do?
Nothing.
Just home, stay at home.
Yeah, I do. I have a glass of wine, I catch up on my television shows, and I sit quietly.
Ben?
Same. And since I'm 21 as of January, I
have, you can have
a glass of wine as well.
Favorite show other than this one?
Sweeney Todd.
Ragtime.
Okay. And what is the role that you really want to play after this one?
I'm not sure it's been written
Sally
yet.
Bowles.
Oh!
I was in Cabaret when I was like 10 years old.
Amazing. And
but I wasn't Sally Bowles.
Oh, okay.
I was in the
Kit Kat Club.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, then
can I be your MC?
Oh, exactly. That's what we're going to do.
Go.
Okay. Perfect.
All right. Ben Levi Ross and Jessica Phillips, they are starring in the touring production of Dear Evan Hansen. And you can find out more about the show at hereandnow.org. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
It's Here and Now.
And it's the 10th straight day of protest in Puerto Rico. People calling on the island's governor, Ricardo Rossello, to resign after it was revealed that he shared private, pretty despicable, misogynistic and homophobic messages in a group chat. Yesterday, Rossello said he wouldn't run for re-election next year, but he also wouldn't step down until then. Federico de Jesus is the former deputy director of the Puerto Rico Federal Affairs Administration. He now runs a consulting company, FDJ Solutions. He happens to be in San Juan, where protesters are gathering. Federico, what are people saying?
So thank you for having me, Robin, and for covering this important story. People are just saying the governor needs to resign. The hashtag Ricky Renuncia, which means Ricky resign, the governor, Ricardo Rosello, refuses to do so. Yesterday, he announced that he was stepping down as the president of the New Progressive Party, which is the pro-statehood party here in the island, and that he will not seek re-election in 2020. But people are saying that he's tone deaf, that that's not what the mandate of the people is, that he needs to resign. People are fed up with the corruption, the insults and the mismanagement of the hurricane. And a lot of people are also fed up that Donald Trump, in a certain extent, was right when he called the island authorities corrupt. And people are standing up in one voice and saying, no, that's not who we are. We are decent people, and this is unacceptable.
Well, and the texts were just so bad. I don't want you to say what they were in detail, but, you know, talking about women, talking about hurricane survivors. And as you say, the governor is wrestling with this huge debt. And this is coming on top of all of that.
Well, and a lot of Puerto Ricans are afraid that, this governor's mismanagement and obviously the reputational damage of the text and potential criminal liability and persecution of journalists and other political enemies have really closed the door for this administration, the Rosello administration in Washington. He's been able to unite Democrats like Congressman Raul Grijalva, which was the first one to call for his resignation, and Marco Rubio, and even President Trump, all in one voice, which are saying that this government has no credibility left, and that's what the people are saying. Mm-hmm. And right now, hundreds of thousands of people along the Las Americas Expressway here in San Juan demand the governor's immediate resignation.
Yeah. Look, huge protests on this island have worked before. Talk about that.
Sure. Well, the last time that hundreds of thousands marched along this same expressway was in the year 2000, during a similar situation when people united in one voice to kick the U.S. Navy out of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques, which was a training ground where the Navy used depleted uranium and other contaminants that really harmed the health and the environment there. And Puerto Ricans got fed up and united in one voice. I would venture to say that this is far larger in terms of the consensus. There's not one person that I've talked to, whether they belong to the governor's party or not, that wants him to remain in office. And that is a consensus that is hard to achieve. Sometimes I joke that Puerto Ricans are as divided as the Catholics and the Protestants mm-hmm. in Northern Ireland. Our politics have always divided us in terms of what this Caribbean Commonwealth nation wants to do with its relationship with the United States. But right now, nobody's talking about that. They're all united in that the governor needs to resign and that a future free of corruption and a resilient island will hopefully take hold after this governor leaves office.
Federico de Jesus, the former deputy director of the Puerto Rico Federal Affairs Administration there in San Juan today. Federico, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The news last week, first reported by the Washington Post, of just how much the pharmaceutical industry has been flooding the country with opioids. 76 billion pills in the U.S. between 2006 and 12. That news was enraging, given the addiction epidemic. But it's not a surprise to researchers at the University of Michigan Medical School, who've been combing through insurance data to find cases of overuse of opioids. They're currently putting together a report on overprescribing opioids after tooth extraction. And they've issued their findings on the misuse of opioids for sprained ankles. We'll link you at herenow.org. Dr. Chad Brummett is one of the researchers. Dr. Brummett, so you had this insurance data of over 500,000 people who saw doctors for sprained ankles. Thousands got prescriptions for opioids. You could see them fill them immediately. Then some went back. Tell us more.
We used a national database of privately insured patients and looked at both the prescribing rate as well as the rate in which people became what we would call new persistent opioid users or new chronic users, mm-hmm. which is a continued fill 3 to 6 months later. And we found that about 8% of people were given an opioid as a part of that ankle sprain diagnosis. And of that 8%, another 8% went on to become new persistent opioid users.
And you can tell because, again, through this data, you can see that 3 or 6 months down the line, they were still filling prescriptions for a sprained ankle. Now, let's be clear. Are you supposed to give opioids for sprained ankles?
None of the recommendations for how to manage sprained ankles recommend opioids as a part of that care. So, no.
No, you're not. What are you supposed to? I mean, I've sprained my ankle. I've taken an ibuprofen.
You're right on there, Robin. So we certainly know that many people won't seek any medical care for a sprained ankle. But even among those who do get care for a sprained ankle, we don't spend a lot of time in the early phases actually even grading or saying how bad that ankle sprain is. Really, the things that you do at home are appropriate. And for those that do seek care, an orthopedic surgeon or an emergency medicine physician would help you decide whether or not immobilization like a splint or a boot is a part of that care, or even crutches in some cases.
To be clear here, rather than doing what you just said, you saw that out of 592,000 patients, about 11.9% filled an opioid prescription within 7 days of diagnosis, and that of those, around 8% had never had an opioid prescription before. And yet, 3 months down the line, they were filling out an opioid prescription again. That must turn your stomach.
Well, it's bothersome. It's unfortunately quite consistent with what we've seen in the surgical literature. Our team has very focused on what to do with safe and appropriate prescribing after surgery. And we've found that about 6 to 8% of people after elective surgery continue to use opioids long past what would be deemed normal surgical recovery. And the same thing is true in dentistry, where 80% of kids will get an opioid as a part of a wisdom tooth extraction, despite the fact that we don't recommend opioids for tooth extraction.
You just looked at insurance data, the amount of people who'd gone in for the sprained ankles, and then what happened with opioid prescriptions. So I know you weren't looking at any other connections, but we are seeing the recent reporting on just how much this industry overproduced and manufactured and flooded parts of the country with opioids. Do you think that this is a part of that story?
I do believe that the influence of industry influenced prescribing among providers and also the want among patients for those opioids. So patients coming in and saying, hey, I have a bad ankle sprain. I want an opioid. I have pain. Give me a pain medication. And we've unfortunately equated pain and pain medications to opioids when there are other non-opioid pain medications like ibuprofen and other non-steroidals that would be more appropriate for care of an ankle sprain.
Do you think it's also possible, Dr. Brummett, that people are going in to doctors they know will prescribe them opioids saying they have an ankle sprain when they don't?
We certainly hear the stories and have seen the stories of patients that seek care to get opioids or feign injuries. Unfortunately, while I do believe that that is real, I also think that there are patients who don't know better, who are just there trying to get the best medical care possible, who get opioids as a part of their care. I don't think there are hundreds of thousands of patients out there seeking opioids on a daily basis just as a way to feed an opioid use disorder or opioid addiction. I think that there is a public perception issue in the U.S. where we believe that opioids are effective for all types of pain and appropriate for all types of pain, and they're not.
Dr. Chad Brummett of the University of Michigan School of Medicine will link you to his team's new research report on the increase in patients being prescribed opioids after a simple ankle sprain, something that should not happen. Dr. Brummett, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, we talked today about the heat. One way to keep cool is to go camping. In the western part of the country, that sometimes means camping for free on public lands. More people are putting down stakes in forests, mountains, deserts, and the federal government may soon start cracking down. Nate Hedgie from member station KUER reports.
The Red Rock Desert north of Moab, Utah, is beginning to fill with campers. SUVs and retrofitted vans slowly roll across dirt roads searching for an open spot. James Gustine and his wife Jamie are lucky. They found one earlier this morning.
Camping in Moab is brutal. I mean, just getting a spot can be full-on competition, and it didn't used to be that way.
This used to be a quiet destination for rock climbers and mountain bikers in the region, the kind of place where you could roll in on a Sunday and not see a lot of people. But now, low gas prices, a strong U.S. economy, and a population boom in some western cities all appear to be driving more people to visit cool outdoor meccas, places like Moab here in Utah, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and Fruta, Colorado. Many of those visitors practice dispersed camping. Dispersed camping is essentially bargain basement camping. No toilets, no electrical hookups, no designated campsite. You simply find some previously trampled upon ground and sleep right there. Gustine loves it.
It's free. We get away from the crowds. The dog can run around. Just a little more space, really.
But space is increasingly hard to find. Today, the Gustines are surrounded by camper trailers and tall black live-in vans.
Yeah, it takes away from the experience. I don't come out here to be around huge crowds. That's not the reason I'm out here.
And huge crowds aren't the only problem. About a quarter mile away from where the Gustines are camping, Lisa Bryant is staring at some dirty paper towels half buried in the sand.
Okay, I'm not going to pick it up. The way they're wadded up and stuffed into the dirt,
I wouldn't pick those up.
Bryant is a spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management's Moab Field Office.
You know, you don't want to be camping in this. You don't want to be experiencing this as part of your public lands. That's not cool.
And that's why the BLM recommends people dig their cat holes a lot deeper here, or they carry out their waste. Because improperly buried human waste is not only gross, it's also unsanitary, and it can contaminate nearby water supplies. And people are damaging the landscape in other ways, like illegally driving off the road to find quiet spots to camp. Bryant points to a tire rut that had crushed some plants.
This is just resource damage. These soils are compacted now, harder for plants to get in and grow.
All of this has spurred the BLM to propose restricting some dispersed camping areas near popular trails and introduce managed camping sites. For example, in Moab, the agency has long-range plans to build 5 new $20-a-night campgrounds, complete with fire rings and proper toilets. Mike Souza isn't a fan of that idea. He's a retired plumber from California. We find him in the shade of his camper trailer. His 2 old red cattle dogs come over to greet us.
No running.
Hello.
Souza has been vacationing in Moab for 30 years. He says the desert is definitely becoming more crowded, but he believes that clamping down on dispersed camping isn't the answer.
I feel like when they close something down, I say, well, you know, why? I pay taxes to be able to use this.
He feels like creating designated campsites and fee campgrounds will just drive more people to other dispersed camping areas, leading to some of the same problems there. Instead, Souza says people need to learn better camping etiquette.
You know, they don't realize that this could be taken away. They think it's theirs. They don't know it's a privilege. And that's the problem.
And right now, it's a problem that's mostly confined to areas near popular trails and climbing routes. So if you really want some peace and quiet, park the car, grab your tent, get off the trails, and start walking. For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgy in Moab, Utah.
And Nate's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
The population of New York City officially shrank last year. That's according to the St. Louis Federal Reserve. It is the first time that's happened in 40 years. And our next guest says it's a sign that American cities have become too difficult for raising children. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, and explain the connection here, why the population shrinkage has to do with children.
So there are two ways for a city to grow. You can have more people move into it, or you can have more people be born into it. That is, more babies. And New York and a lot of other dense, expensive coastal cities have two problems right now. One, more Americans are leaving than coming in. And two, fewer babies are being born there. So their growth is almost entirely dependent on more immigration. Since 2011, the number of babies born in New York has declined almost 10% in the 5 boroughs and 15% in Manhattan alone. At that rate, Manhattan's infant population would halve in 30 years. And it's not just the fact that there are fewer babies. It's the fact that once those kids become school age, that is precisely when parents decide that the place is too expensive for them, too inconvenient, and they move on to cheaper cities in the suburbs.
And obviously, they're not being offset by immigrants coming in or another group.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting because I talked to this economist, Jed Kolko, who's a whiz with census data. And I said, I don't want this article to be just about New York. I want to look at all dense urban areas. Tell me which groups are shrinking and tell me which groups are growing. He said the groups that are shrinking tend to be groups like those without a college education, with their eldest child over 6. Both those groups are declining, have declined by 5% in the biggest, richest cities this century. What group is growing the fastest? A, people with adults with no children, and B, most importantly, white college graduates with a high income with no school-age kids. So to summarize this in case it's too complicated, those without a college degree or those with older kids are leaving cities, and those who are making more money with a college degree who don't have school-age kids, their share of the population in major U.S. cities is growing.
So, and I say this as a person who grew up not in a major city, but in a college town. And I grew up on a block with, I think, 24 kids on my block. So there was always somebody to play with. But what are the downsides of cities that don't have as many kids as they used to.
Yeah, I think there are three downsides. The first downside is just economic equity. It's unfair for the middle and lower classes that cities, which used to be a beautiful amalgamation of families, no longer serve for middle class and lower income families, that it's harder to raise a family there. That's number one. Number two, there's some sort of larger economics problems of depopulation. If you have cities discouraging families from having kids, then over time that leads to a smaller working age population, which makes it harder for us to pay for things like Medicare and Social Security. And then third, I think it's bad politically. I think it's bad to have a situation where the rich and the liberal are clustering in cities and essentially making their votes less powerful, while you have these sort of red rural plains of America and these states that have, you know, not as dense population that count a lot more in the Electoral College. I think that creates, frankly, the beginnings of a constitutional crisis, that it goes right against this American principle of one man or woman, one vote. And so I see some negative political consequences coming from the childless city as well.
Are cities doing anything to combat this? Obviously, there's been a sort of a theme in some of the big cities in this country in recent years where they say, well, in order for this city to be the best it can be, we've got to have great schools so that people want to live in the city and raise their kids in the city. Are you seeing anything that would reverse this trend?
Yes, I got a lot of great feedback from this piece from people saying you need to look closer at what's happening in Vancouver, that Vancouver has been very purposeful about building neighborhoods and institutions and schools and urban habits that make it easier for a middle-class family to raise kids there. That essentially is going to be my next project. So I can't talk about it too much now, but that is, I think, the next question to ask.
Okay, and we should also note that you are being part of the population shrinking of New York City because you're leaving yourself to move to Washington, D.C., where you can raise your kids, right, Derek?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. When writers leave New York, it's common for them to write a grandiose essay about why I'm leaving New York. So this was, in the spirit of Joan Didion, my essentially why I'm leaving New York essay, masking as a piece of urban analysis. But I am indeed leaving the humid and media-obsessed city of New York City to join the even more humid and even more media-obsessed city of Washington, D.C.
Okay. Well, while we have you, just a couple of seconds here, Derek, but you've written about the power of familiarity and nostalgia, so I wanted to mention that The Lion King, the remake, had a $185 million opening weekend. Your thoughts?
No surprise at all. If we've learned anything from the movie business over the last two decades, it's that Americans only flock to the theater en masse predictably when it's a familiar piece of intellectual property. Nothing is more familiar than essentially redoing The Lion King with realistic animals. So this was not surprising, but a huge win for Disney.
Or they go when it's hot.
They go to get the air conditioning.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now.